Well, hello everyone. I'm joined today by Paula Wright, who I've kind of noticed on Twitter and elsewhere, who, like many people, myself included, has somewhat had enough of, let's say, gender wars slop, is the best way to describe it. And, you know, I think we have quite a lot on the, let's just say, the male perspective on this issue. You know, in and around these sorts of spheres. So I thought it'd be interesting to discuss Paula's experience with gender war stuff, etc. So yeah, I mean, Paula, first of all, for people who don't, for people who won't be aware of you, say a bit about yourself and then we can talk.
Okay, I'm Paula Wright. I used to be Sexy Isn't Sexist on Twitter, but I've changed my name to at Paula Wright. That was named after a kind of stand-up thing I did, and an essay I did on the gender wars about 10 years ago now. Yeah, I'm a evolutionary psychologist, but I'm not in academia, and I'm not you know, dogmatic in that sense either. I'm kind of quite philosophical on certain issues, just looking at things from a kind of realist perspective, basically. And just trying to work out, you know, what the F is going on.
So, I mean, I don't know where to start this, really, because I feel like gender war stuff has been going on possibly even longer than the wider culture wars. You know, men, the basic frame of men versus women, pretty much as long as I can remember. Even going back into the mists of the, you know, even in the 90s, there was, you know, Spice Girls and Girl Power and all this sort of stuff, and the New Lads. I was a teenager in the New Lads period,
you know. Yeah, men behaving stuff like that. Yeah,
men behaving badly and all that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, it's been a little bit confusing to navigate, because coming out of the 90s, you were kind of given a bit of a permission to, and in the Blair era, ironically, you were kind of given permission to be a little bit of a lad, and also a little bit, dare I say, like, ironically chauvinistic in that era. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of kind of ironic chauvinism that went on. But by the same token, you know, certainly in my youth, right, in that period, girl, there was this such a thing as the ladette. Do you remember that? It was like,
oh, Zoe, yeah, and the ladettes, yeah. And I mean, I was the ladette probably in that time, yeah.
Girls drinking pints,
smoking, and,
but I mean, people forget, like, it wasn't unheard of for, you know, to be out with a group of girls and they might like smack a boy on the bum and stuff. I feel like the youth, I feel like the girls now don't do that sort of thing as much. Like, I feel that that strain of ladettism kind of came and went.
Yeah, well, it was more kind of fun. It was more fun. It wasn't as it is now, is it? Which I see it as a kind of chauvinism. But I see the rise of chauvinism in both men and women at the minute. Back then, it was, as you say, kind of like ironic, tongue in cheek. The post feminists of that time, you know, the Guardian journalists were in despair about it. I was doing my dissertation at the time, and I did a dissertation about this and about feminism in the media and how they'd kind of just been assaulted by this new paradigm of ironic laddism and the ladette as well. And there was a book just out at the time called Female Chauvinist Pigs by a woman called Ariel Levy. And so that was all the rage at the time. They were in despair that, you know, feminism had, well, it was post-feminism. It was the end of feminism, and now kind of, but then intersectionality came in the tens and changed everything.
Yeah, and one of the ways that it changed that I can remember, I mean, I was in academia for a long time, so I saw all of this up close, was that kind of slightly ironic humor after a certain time was met with a kind of po-faced puritanical thing, which I could never get on with. It doesn't jive well with my, I like to have a mess about. I can, you know, I can, I like people who are authentic and I can have a laugh with them and so on. And there was a period there where it was a very pure strain of what I can only describe as a kind of puritanical, dogmatic, you couldn't really have a laugh with some of these more kind of stern-faced feminists.
No, they kind of took out, they kind of took the medical, what the kind of disability kind of rights people had been doing during that time, and then applied that to feminism, and then out of that came woke and or that kind of thing. Yeah, it kind of became an identity rather than just something you agreed with or didn't agree with.
And I'll tell you, I can remember right in the height of Me Too, I was at a bar in, where was I? It was either in New Orleans or Atlanta, Georgia. I think I was in Atlanta, Georgia for an academic conference. And I was sitting with two or three female feminist academics. And this was like in the height of Me Too. Okay, so you can imagine. And I said, because I've never been one to like hide my, I would just always speak candidly. And I was at this bar with them and I said, look, the thing is, the problem, not only for the kids now, but for when I was a teenager as well, is that since the 60s, men and women have been expected to kind of find their own way, and they're given quite literally no guidance whatsoever. There used to be a set of courting rituals. There were manuals on how to behave like a lady and how to be a gent, and how, like, there were literally manuals on the courting process. In Iran, where my dad is from, before getting married, the couple, like, there's all sorts of hurdles that have to be crossed. Like, the two families have to meet and everybody has to be sure that, you know, so there's a whole set of kind of codes and conventions before two people get together. Whereas in the 90s, when I grew up, it was literally just whoever you get off with in the nightclub. And, you know, I mean, I remember in my town, there was a mural on the kind of bit of artwork on the club, on the local nightclub wall. And it just said jackpot with two fingers pointing there. And, you know, basically if you got off with a girl, you know, that was your jackpot and you were on the jackpot wall. And, you know, that's how most people met back in the day. That's how, like, literally most people got together. Well, you can then imagine if the rules are, there are basically no rules, and the only thing you've got to go on is literally like Spice Girls and Oasis, and, you know, most parents were very liberal, just going to let you go out or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're basically not getting any guidance whatsoever. And I remember one of them said to me, you know, you're not scared to be a radical thinker, are you? And I was like, is there anything I just said radical? I thought it was just basic common sense. But I still think this is a problem now. I still think that even after, you know, all of this time, young people have even less of a sense of what they got. I mean, they've got certain diktats that come down from, you know, these types of feminists, but they're so, like, ridiculous that they basically end up being ignored. And so it's like there's no framework at all. So I feel like young people are just being asked to figure it out. And it's weirdly resulted in the two genders, like, coming apart and people not having sex and not even having babies and things like that. So,
well, there is a structural thing to that. If you know, because ever since kind of education opened its doors to this, what was supposed to be liberal feminism, of course, you know, that's a Trojan horse thing. Once the doors were open, and then all of the nutcases came in, intersectionality, radical feminism, all of this kind of thing. And it went into our schools and it started telling women that they were uniquely vulnerable. It started telling boys that they were uniquely toxic, and how to kind of, and that basically having a relationship, you know, having normal kind of, you know, relationships like between peers, rather than, you know, girls going out and having and meet and pretending to be like 18 when they're 15 and going into bars and meeting men, rather than having relationships with their peers in school and experimenting with peers as generally every generation has ever done, they are just basically just estranged from each other, and even more so now. That's never changed. The messages that are going in and out of schools, you know, with the showing adolescents in schools, even though it's a pile of absolute rubbish. And of course, none of this. Girls are being told constantly, you are vulnerable, you are a victim, but you also can be strong and do anything you want as long as you avoid boys, as long as you avoid the trap of having a family.
So at once you're vulnerable, but also you're like Rey from Star Wars or Aya Stark or something. Yeah. There's a lot of action girls now.
Yeah, it's like those adverts for like sanitary towels when they can do everything, but then they can climb mountains, you know, they can do all these things, but then the next day in, I don't know, Hello, there'll be an op-ed about kind of like, should we have days off for periods? It's like, make your fucking mind up. Come on.
Mm-hmm. So when this conversation, you know, I listen to a lot of LBC for my sins and in the car, LBC radio. I know it's, you know, but I find it a good way to check in with what, you know, normies are talking about. And whenever this topic comes up, within minutes, the conversation turns around to being mainly about Andrew Tate. Don't know, and I don't know why that is, but well, I mean, I do, because he's got a very large following. But the conversation then is like, you know, there'll be some MP on there, or there'll be some like expert, and they'll say, well, look, it's clearly the culture is letting young men down. We want positive messages to reach young men, because at the moment they're being captured by toxic men like Andrew Tate. So, you know, when we talk about gender wars slop, in a way, this does seem like something like it. On the one extreme end, you've got Andrew Tate telling men to, work out, become kind of like these almost like hedonistic pimps, something like this, right? And then on the other extreme end, you've got like the blue-haired feminist, and then the kind of conversation that happens on LBC is how do we stop losing the young men to Andrew Tate? So before we even get into what happens online, let's just deal with the big ticket normie conversation at LBC. If you were calling into LBC, what would you say?
Well, I used to go on talk radio about 10 years ago when Matthew Wright used to be on it. He would ring me up and say these things in the news and stuff. And I think around about that, I think I actually knew Andrew Tate when he had hair, you know, online. Right. This was about like 10, 15 years ago. And he even tried flirting with me once. But I think, you know, obviously they're picking Andrew Tate because he's the most ostentatious. He's the most, I guess, if you were just going to like pick somebody who's the most grotesque version of the manosphere red pill kind of thing, the kind of most lowbrow, immediate kind of just, it's going to be him. And it's like Trump has to be Hitler. Because if he's not Hitler, then you have to. There's a dialectic going on where it's kind of this is what the worst is, which is why you have to come back to us, which is what the discussion was about Trump. He's Hitler, so you can't vote for him, so you have to vote for us. It's kind of like there's no in between. And of course, Andrew Tate isn't. Andrew Tate's a Muslim. He practices. He's basically got harem. So what he's showing online, I think he's got absolute contempt for his male audience, actually, because what he's showing is I've got like, I don't know how many wives he's got or girlfriends or whatever like that. But it's certainly not in a operational sex ratio kind of terms. He's taking partners away from average or even non-average men. He's kind of pooling all of these resources, showing it ostentatiously and going, oh, well, you can be like me. Well, you know, the math doesn't add up there. All men can't then just pool 20 women around themselves. You know, some men, even more men, then are going to be left with absolutely no mates, no choice in the mating market. So he's pushing a kind of this picture, which is completely false, that it's like freeing. What it's really kind of like, he's lying to people's faces. and saying with and winking and saying that that it's a good thing, when actually I think he's got just contempt for everybody, men and women, really.
So I mean, one of the things, I mean, having tracked, I've never really been, you know, in the manosphere or in that kind of, like, I've always, but I've been aware of it the whole, you know, the whole time, because it's, I guess, a strand. I remember there's a chap called Vox Day who made something back in the day, which was very influential, called the psychosexual hierarchy, right? Now, even if you haven't heard of Vox Day, you'll have heard of these terms. He said, listen, you're basically, as a man, you're either an alpha or a beta, right? Or the delta or the gamma, or you could be a sigma like me, right? That was the whole thing. And that, regardless of whether you've heard him or not, that basic idea, I think, has been very influential, and it's been incredibly limiting and dispiriting to a lot of young men. You know, I'm kind of interested in the power of people to transform themselves and improve and things like that. But if you tell someone, listen, you're basically like this class of man, right? You're a gamma, or you're like you basically have no chance. All of the women will go to the Andrew Tates because he's an alpha, right? Whereas you're going to be, and in the even more toxic end of it, it's, you know, there are other notions, like, for example, if you're a beta, then your wife or your girlfriend will inevitably cuckold you with the alpha. And you're basically like, kind of, you know, you're there to pick up the damaged goods type thing. Yeah. And all of this, you can see, so on the one hand, you've got the pickup artist side of it and the Andrew Tate side of it. But then on the other end, you have, you know, what they call the incel culture, with young men who basically decide that because of all of these things, because of these hard truths that come out of evolutionary psychology, that, you know, they've got no option but to check out, become an incel, to never have, you know, I'm never going to have a girlfriend. It doesn't matter how much I work out or anything, I'm never going to get there. Or even in the absolute doomsday scenario, I might as well just become a woman. I might as well just become a troon, you know. So, I mean, first of all, as an you said you're into kind of evolutionary biology, psychology. Is there any actual factual basis to all this stuff? Or because I think it's actually damaging for people to get into that mindset, because you're basically saying you're basically making a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way.
It's what it is. It's kind of like the manosphere, the red pill community kind of heard a few, I don't know, things from evolutionary psychology. And then rather than looking, you know, at the detail and the crosstabs and all of those kinds of things that you do in these studies, or looking at, you know, meta-analyses of like, kind of, was it replicated, all this kind of thing. So they take it and they run with it because it fits their ideology. I mean, the red pill, the manosphere, you know, incels are such a tiny group, you know, and they've always existed. They've always been like autistic men who are shy and don't want to go out. And, you know, my colleague, William Costello, is kind of the main person who studies incels at the minute. And, you know, he's found out they're not a danger to anyone. They're more a danger to themselves. They're a tiny community. They're not white. They're mostly ethnic minorities. And you know, it's a moral panic that's going on around incels. But the thing about alpha, beta, you know, human mating is, these are all terms that come from a bastardization of kind of lots of things like evolutionary biology, evolutionary anthropology, primatology, all this kind of thing. Humans are humans. They're not chimps. They're not gorillas. They're not pygmies, as, you know, feminists like to kind of look at pygmy chimps because they have sex with everybody all of the time and try to kind of make those kinds of parallels. We're not pygmy chimps either. We're not bonobos. Humans are humans. And actually, the evolutionary biology points very specifically to us not being a promiscuous or you know, wildly, you know, slutty species, really. There are certain biological markers that, that species like that, like say chimps, chimp females kind of mate with loads of males, right? And what happens there, you'll notice, I've written something, it's on my Substack, you'll notice chimps have massive balls, right? And that's because they, because of sperm competition that happens inside the reproductive tract of the female. Now that the male chimps release so much sperm in order to wash out whatever was in there before, okay?
Yeah.
Because that's the adaptations that have grown with chimps in that promiscuous psychosexual, you know, adaptations. Humans don't have massive balls. They don't need to wash out, you know, that kind of thing. They have kind of like, they have much bigger penises than chimps or anything. Gorillas, on the other hand, who have harems, and the women, you know, are kept very, very tightly within those groups. Gorillas have tiny balls because they literally don't have to fight. There's no sperm competition going on inside the female reproductive tract at all. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as that. They're massive though, because they have to fight. They fight physically, rather than the competition happens physically outside the reproductive tract. Whereas in promiscuous species, the competition happens inside the female reproductive tract, which means lots of sperm competition, that kind of thing. So, you know, just take it. It's like any kind of slop you want to take. It's kind of like a meme, an idea that's really catchy. It catches on, and it unfortunately, yeah, it kind of people get stuck in the algorithm. And there are people, like there are feminists who are going to exploit female fear, which is again an adaptive response to, you know, that they are vulnerable to certain things. And men, and I think that men's rights, most of men's rights activists, red pill people, all this kind of thing, are actually exploiting male fear of cuckoldry, which to a certain extent is allegorical, or, you know, the same as a woman's fear of rape. To a certain extent, it kind of violates her choice, her reproductive choice. It messes up her future, you know, in so many ways, as does cuckoldry in men. That's probably the male, you know, the same thing, that men adaptively are going to have that fear. That's the worst thing that can happen to you in an evolutionary sense. It's just going to completely wipe your evolutionary legacy away. And so we've got both of these sides, as you will, just completely exploiting very primal predispositions of human psychology.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of the young men, the thing I worry about is that it's just demoralizing. It's a demoralizing, I mean, everybody talks about identity these days, right? But on a personal level, if you're identifying, right, if you identify with, you know, oh, there's this hierarchy and I'm the loser on it, and I'm basically guaranteed to be cuckolded or something like that, if that's your basic view of yourself, that can't be healthy for anybody to have that as their kind of identity. So I mean, I've done my own, I mean, it's not the main thing I do, but here and there, I have tried to push back on this sort of thing. And, you know, I encourage men not to watch pornography, because I think that's one of the real avenues through which a lot of this poison is actually snuck in. It's actually snuck in, because, you know, if you think about the way somebody's identity can be rewired, or these like images that you keep on replaying over and over and over again, I'm convinced that there is some link. I mean, again, I've done no studies, it's just an intuition I've got, that there's a link between certain types of strange porn that people are into these days,
strange
and
porn.
Many of the the so-called modern pathologies that people have, and the explosion of you know, not necessarily the LGBT bit, but all the other stuff like the 52. I mean, so much of it must be reinforced in some level, porn. But
I mean, even I wonder how many.
Yep. Even if you don't go there, sorry, there's also just the basics of when young men and young women meet, and let's just say strange expectations that come from too much watching of this sort of thing, you know. But anyway, go on, Paula. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Well, I just wonder about how much of the new pathologies are actually just the same old pathologies, just kind of being streamed through different mechanisms, and comparing yourself to other people obviously is something that humans have always done, and it's always been a source of either motivation, I want to be like that, or demoralization. And social media certainly is a mechanism that, well, I mean, we've never before in history, you know, had such a wide social network. You know, I think of it almost like, you know, it's like social diabetes. It's you know, we grew up and kind of maybe had like an extended community of maybe it's like never past 100 people, like in the history of, you know, of the human species. And now it's like the salt and the fat issue, the evolutionary mismatch we have with them now. Now there's a glut of salt and fat and carbohydrates, and there's a glut of sociality, but it's not real, and it's likely very unhealthy. So women's social media is all like that. It's they're scrutinizing each other physically in a way that men don't do. And so this kind of social grooming thing happens with the likes. The like is everything. Even if you don't like it, you have to be seen to like something or something like that. And what's, yeah, and what's happening with men? I think definitely it's demoralizing for both of them. I don't know about pornography. I'm kind of obviously, I think what I think the data says is that people who are already predisposed to kind of violence and stuff like that watch violent pornography and watch their kink and things like that, and are more likely to kind of pass that on. But there's also a kind of studies that show in the West, though, only in the West. I've asked just maybe if we can get some data from non-Western countries, because I think the cultural element that definitely goes with this. But in the West, when more porn basically equals less sexual assault on the street. So there seems to be like a mechanism going on where men's the release that they need, and if that is true, then, you know, what will happen? And this is, you know, obviously predictions kind of like hopefully show the meat of any kind of theory. If I think we've seen something like after facial ID, you know, on the internet, they've seen a drop in like 60% of pornography use. I'm just wondering if there's actually then going to be a 60% rise in sexual assault on the street,
wouldn't it?
So I mean, are we going to see that drop of watching porn, but then that rise of that? But so I mean, I'm not kind of morally fussed about the pornography kind of thing. I understand that people are worried about what is demoralizing and what is kind of hacking young people's brains. And we need to definitely study it, and we need to definitely, you know, find the key causes of that. But yeah, just finding out, just actually delving into that and finding the real causes. Because obviously, like I said, what happens if you're ideologically kind of attached to an anti-porn, but then suddenly you implement that, and then sexual assaults is the consequence.
I hadn't really considered that. I mean, obviously they're probably the guys who are going to do sexual assault are probably a, you know, a sharp tail or whatever.
Yeah.
Sharp.
And they're all the same as well. It's like people think every sexual assault is a different person. They're not. It's the same people committing the same sexual assault.
I guess my concern is not with that guy, but like with the median guy or the person who should have confidence in life, but they're getting it like literally I mean, there's other, I mean, I don't want to get into it too much, but, you know, there's various, you know, you can talk about like male potency. It's going to sound like weird, but if you spend all your time doing that, you won't have the kind of vitality to just go out there and do stuff. It's kind of like saps. It's like a vampiric source that's pushing your creativity. So I view it in that way. Mm-hmm. But you're probably right that from a society, from a like a sociology point of view, maybe that it has some other strange some side
utility.
Effect.
But yeah, like I say, I think Western might will work because, to put it, you know, Western men are civilized, and we mm-hmm. and our governments don't use sexual crimes as a way to maintain control. You know, I've seen all these things about the burqa and things like that. You know, women have to wear burqa in the Middle East and those kinds of countries, because if they don't, then the culture kind of facilitates their sexual assault by the men there. That doesn't happen here, or at least it shouldn't. You know, you even see Muslim women who would not be going out without somebody with them, like their brother or their father. They'll wear their burqa, but they'll go out by themselves. They'll go out with their pushchair and go through Primark and do all their shopping and stuff like that. They wouldn't be allowed to do that without a male relative watching them in another country. And that's a facet of, you know, because it's safer. It's much safer here, what it used to be.
Interesting. So I'm going to play my ad a second. I have a sale on at the moment. It's 25% off all my courses, promo code COOL. But when we come back, we focus mainly on men so far. When we come back, I want to focus a little bit on the impact on women and young girls. And, you know, I'm a dad. I have a 6-year-old daughter. So obviously it's a concern to me as she grows up as well. But also I'm kind of interested. I'm kind of interested with your kind of lens as to what you're going to say, but let's watch the ad. It's promo code COOL. Buy a course today. Cool. Everybody wants to be cool. Like this guy. This guy is cool. Do you know who else is cool? People who do courses at the academic agency. And you too can be cool by getting a course today with promo code COOL, which gets you 25% off all courses. Today. Promo code COOL.
Who's your model?
I don't actually know. I just I saw it and I thought I was entertained by his kind of 70s suaveness. Or his 80s, it's more 80s style, yeah. Really, wasn't it? Okay, so one of the things that I've seen during my lifetime is a message pushed on young girls. It certainly was when I was a teenager in the era of the Ledette, but I don't think this has fully gone away. Yes, you have the narratives of vulnerability and women are at risk, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I would say alongside that or almost overriding that sometimes is this idea that girls can be like men. And when I say girls can be like men, right, let's just go back to the 90s a second. You know, when I was going out, we would sit around and it would be, you know, they were lads, every hole's a goal. You know, if you pulled, that was considered an achievement on the night out, all that sort of stuff. Men can, I mean, I've always believed that men can handle that in a way that I just fundamentally have never believed that women can. And that I have never known a girl who has been promiscuous, who's been happy with themselves because of it. They actually, like, regardless of their upbringing, it seems to be a cause of some sort of distress if they're doing that sort of behavior. You know that something's up. And this is something that I wonder what you think about in general, because I've seen the stats that young people are having less sex, but I've also seen other stats that dating apps and things like that have actually led to some kind of Andrew Tate effect where, you know, it's actually super easy for a girl to get a date, go out and have sex if she wants it like that. Because this is another thing I've always believed, that it might be hard for a man to pull, but for a girl to pull, She just has to wink at the right guy and he'll sleep with her, right? That's why I've always thought it'd be super easy to be gay, because you get tons of sex, right? Because there's no the limiter. There's no limiter. There's nobody saying no. It's the girl who says no, right?
Yeah, because she gets pregnant. Always...
yeah, exactly. So, but so I still want, you know, and you mentioned The Guardian earlier on. There's always some article in The Guardian with some like 40-year-old female journalist trying to argue that she goes out, she's promiscuous, she's never been happier, you know, she's happy to be alone and play the field and all this sort of stuff and Sex and the City and all the rest of it. And this seems to be a feminist kind of...
Yeah, well, 40-year-olds kind of are less, going to be less worried or are going to be less kind of have that, they're going to be late. They're not going to have that young girl's predisposition to, you know, be looking for a mate who will commit, right? 40-year-old women have had a lot of sex already, right? They've probably had their kids. That you know, and this is why on dating apps, you know, MILFs and young men hook up very, very often, because they're both just looking for something quite you know, casual and shallow, and then there's young men, young women, they can hook up with somebody you want, but that's not actually what they're looking for. They're looking for, you can say women are the gatekeepers of sex, but men are the gatekeepers to relationships, to actual and that's something again that the manosphere kind of gets from evolutionary psychology and then runs away with it like ridiculously, but it is fundamentally true. It's that, you know, for millions of years, you know, if women didn't choose men who were good providers and who were good mates, if you know, as a species, we would have evolved into something completely different. We might have become chimps or something like that, and we wouldn't have walked on two legs, because you know, that makes us vulnerable as well. If you have to carry a child all of the time because you haven't got a mate who's going to protect you, or a community that's going to protect you and stuff like that, there are so many different variables going on in kind of like how and why we evolved to be who we are today. But there was a study done a long time ago by my mentor Anne Campbell, who it's called the Morning After, and this was in the 90s. She did it as well, but during all of this Ladette kind of time, and it's been reproduced kind of loads and loads of times. And basically, there are sociosexual women. That's a kind of personality thing. There are some women who love lots of sex with lots of different people and are not interested in, but they're a minority. They're definitely a minority in women. The majority of women don't have those kind of predispositions. And these studies find, you know, that no matter what the rhetoric is, pushing women to go out and have lots of different promiscuous sex with lots of different people, they always waiting for that call the next day. They're always waiting, and they're always disappointed when it never comes. And then another mechanism kicks in that kind of tells them, you know, well, it doesn't matter. You know, it's you know, go girl. You know, and then the cultural messages and self-deception especially kicks in. And the girls go out together and they're all commiserate and they bitch about men, and then they'll do it again. And of course, alcohol is a massive kind of thing for that as well.
Yeah. I mean, to my mind, the conversation we've had so far, past 40 minutes or so, nothing but common sense talk by both of us in my mind, even in where we've had some, you know, slight areas of disagreement. What's stopping these sort of conversations happening, like in the mainstream? Like, why doesn't LBC have this sort of chat, or why isn't it discussed in The Guardian in this way? What is the barrier to having these sorts of discourse?
Slop brings ads. It's you can monetize slop and endlessly dish it out. and people will endlessly eat it. Offering a solution is offering kind of like it's the death of a business plan.
What were some solutions look like to the basic problem?
Honestly, I lost my mouse. Crikey. I've looked. You know, I mean, the thing is, I've done a lot of research on female intersexual competition, which basically kind of shows how women compete with other women and, you know, get them to make really stupid choices that harms their, you know, fitness, their psychology. And we'll see, we'll also see that on men and male intersexual competition. There's always more competition within a group than there is without. So there's more competition within groups of men and groups of women than there is actually between men and women. Okay. Now that's something that's constantly just lied about, because the two ideologies that, you know, that people are making a lot of money in the podcast sphere and in new media, just it's like soap opera. It's like the magazines that you used to get that used to have all these crazy kind of stories, these old ladies magazines that they used to have. And then they'd have, my father raped my baby in, just the most ridiculous kind of stuff that you could ever have. And it's just like rubbernecking on the worst kind of things possible. That's just what the podcast sphere is now, either whether it's political or about sex or about health or about supplements or about anything. It's every single, the layers of just slop on top are just, and everybody's just consuming it. And especially the ones that are kind of dressed up as slightly intellectual, like the trigonometry lot, stuff like that. You know, anything that goes on there is already kind of like mainstream, normal. That there's nothing, you know, new that goes on there that's ever going to kind of like change anybody's you know, mind about anything. Working on a book called The Rise of Female Chauvinism, but I'm definitely going to have to put another chapter in, you know, about the concurrent rise of male chauvinism now, because obviously they're all coming together. And just about, I don't know, just maybe getting offline would help. But I mean, how do you do that? Because the algorithm is specifically designed to stop people doing that. It's going to take a lot of brains coming together. I think basically we think that this is just I think this is kind of like a strategy of elite powers, okay, pushing this stuff out there, you know, pushing groups out there. They've given them permission to exercise kind of limited power within the boundaries set by these elites, like feminists are allowed to kind of like, or they believe that they wield authority, but in it, actually they're just executing delegated tasks. Okay, so they're actually on a leash. They're on a really long leash, but it's long enough for them to use as a whip. The first thing I would do is get feminism out of every single institution we have. We have to get rid of feminism, because that's the mechanism, that's the stream that everything flows through.
So if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting that in some way the powers that be actually push gender wars, they actually want this situation, opposed to solving the problem or getting, you know, you said it's going to take brain power, but that's assuming
not,
that
to them it's not a problem. Doing exactly the way it's doing everything it was meant to do, and it's happening on so many different levels. It happens to be that obviously sex is a big seller.
But eventually it is going to be a bit, I mean, it is going to be a big problem because it's causing a demographic, or it's one of the causes of a demographic collapse, not just in Britain, across the world.
Yeah.
A collapse in birth rate.
No, yes. I know. Well, it's causing a collapse in the birth rate. It's not for elites. They're having more babies. But yeah, I mean, I'm working on a research project, which was just accepted by the Danube Institute, to look at one mechanism on that, about how we bring men and women. Just at the minute, the fertility kind of pipeline is: you go to school, you go to uni, you get a job, then you have children. Right. This is about trying to kind of, you go to school, you go to uni. I'm trying to fit the fertility side in there so that people can actually get their education and start families at the same time. Because the problem with the demographic collapse is that it's not necessarily that they're not having enough babies. If they started earlier, they would have more babies. By the time they start in their 30s, they're never going to catch up that lifetime fertility potential. So it's not about taxation. It's not about, you know, throwing money on housing. All those things can happen at the same time, but it's basically just getting men and women into the same environment at the optimal age and creating the conditions where, you know, nature can happen.
Well, people won't remember this, but I mean, you will if you grew up in the 90s like I did. But if you're a teenager in that era, this was actually something that I would blame the Conservatives for more than anyone else, which is the extent to which they absolutely demonized, and I mean demonized, teenage mothers and single mothers and the, you know, all the Vicky Pollard and all of that. Because I remember when I was, you know, in sixth form, so 17, girls were old enough to have babies by that point. You know, I had a girlfriend, long-term girlfriend, but people were just terrified of having a baby. I was terrified. I personally was like, you know, absolutely terrified, like triple contraception, you know, it's just like you take no precautions whatsoever. And I remember there was a girl in our year who had a baby, okay? And the reaction, which should have been like a joyous thing for her, but I remember everybody thinking like, oh my God, what she's done, she ruined her life and all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, well, you know, she's probably perfectly happy now. She's probably got like, you know, starting absolutely at that age, 17, 18, is actually
great grandmother at 40.
But that's actually like, now it's seen as something to mock, like Angela Rayner is a grandmother in her 40s as well. But at one point that was just biologically normal. It's actually the anomaly to start in your 30s or whenever.
Oh yeah.
But
yeah,
that has been what everybody's been pushed into, you know, including me, including practically everybody I know started their family in their 30s.
But you remember that there was an idea going around that young girls were getting pregnant just to get a council house. And today that would be like, so?
Mm-hmm.
And give them an Indigenous woman getting pregnant to have a council house to bring up her family in. What would people see wrong in that today?
So yeah, it did that really, I would say, kill the idea for a generation. How hard, I think it was John Major's government, to be honest, and I don't even know if it came from the top, but it was very much in the culture to just be terrified. And you know, they gave us sex education in school and how to use a condom and all of this sort of stuff because it was really drummed into us. I don't know if that still happens.
It's around the time as well of the idea that, you know, what was it, Malthus? Malthus was right. There was that program from the Ethiopian famine on the news, and he opens with Malthus was right. That, you know, there are far too many people in the world; it's overpopulated, and that kind of idea started to spread into that as well. So yeah, it's just a multi-pronged attack, and.
But then you have the problem of like, well, look, if you start a family when you're 20, how are you going to afford a house? It's just impossible to buy a house in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I'm working class, and Everyone in my generation has never owned a house. I don't, right. I think I might be missing something here, but like the idea of owning your own house as a working class person only became a possibility during Thatcher's time.
And then that was drummed in too. That was massively drummed in to me when I was growing up as well. Yeah.
I don't understand what happened. For again, not probably none of our ancestors ever owned a house, but yet they had multiple children. And even for all the incels and all the demoralized kind of boys out there, every single one of your male ancestors was successful in finding a mate and having children. Mm. Like you come from a very long line of succeeders, of winners in the evolutionary game. So why are you letting whoever, the stranger on the internet, tell you that you don't have it in you to do the same as every single one of your ancestors did?
Mm-hmm. Just before we wrap up, there's one other force that I've seen, especially among young women, it has to be said. Especially young women. Now, I don't know how strong this is as a force, but I've definitely seen it. And every time I see it, I kind of shudder a little bit, which is a really quite militant antinatalism. This is like a young girl who's 22 or something, and she's like militantly against having kids. I'm never going to have children and all this sort of stuff. Where does that come from? What is this?
Well, again, I think that's kind of peer nonsense. I think she'll believe it until she finds somebody that she falls in love with and who says to her, let's have a baby. Mm-hmm. Just like on the what's that podcast called? Call Me Daddy. Mm-hmm. The whole furore about that, that she's been telling women not to get married, not to have babies, and then suddenly she meets someone after years. And is immediately getting married and having a baby. I hate to say it. I'm not going to say it because it's too bad. It is half a joke, but just it used to be sexist to say that women weren't rational. But feminism has made that actually an empirical fact. it's half a joke because a lot of men aren't rational either. I'm sorry to say it's kind of, but. Yeah, I think it's just about peer pressure. I think it's just about cultural messaging. I think, girls say a lot of shit in order to be popular and to fit into a group. And actually finding a relationship, finding a good guy to have a family with is a way for her to escape that female toxicity, really, because all of the women around you, as soon as an opportunity pops up, will take it, just like the host of the Call Me Daddy podcast. They'll tell you and you and you not to do these things. They'll tell you to cut your hair, even though in the hope that it'll make you look less attractive, okay, to make them look better. Just take the kind of like heart to hearts that girls, that your girlfriends and best friends have with you lightly, I'd say, and put your own interests. Find out who you are and then follow that. Yeah. And same with boys.
I guess one of my more, chauvinist, but one of the things I've come to believe is that If a man is secure in himself and confident enough to take the lead in whatever's going on, and I don't mean that in a kind of toxic way or giving orders or anything like that, like not like a little emperor, but just somebody who's confident in himself, okay, to lead and to be himself, that in a kind of healthy dynamic, I mean. Hesitate to say this, but I find that most of the time that women will kind of naturally kind of gravitate towards the man in their life if she really likes him, You know, yeah. I mean, even in like time, I mean, I'm just thinking about like different girlfriends I've had, you know, suddenly like, I mean, just really tiny little things like, you know, I used to like Bob Dylan quite a lot. And suddenly my girlfriend likes Bob Dylan, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or whatever it is, it's just that kind of thing. And I think that for men, not for all women, obviously there's, you know, spectrums, but for many women, if they find the right guy, you know, they're kind of put at ease. They don't actually want to be put in that role of having to take the lead or be the quote-unquote be the man, or, you know, and that's where a lot of the anxiety and the unhappiness of a lot of modern women comes from, I think, is because society keeps on telling them that they can do this role, which actually goes against a lot of their nature. Is that too much to say that?
No, I mean, it's basically, yeah, it's basically right. Like you say, there are women who are going to book that trend, and there are men who are going to book that trend as well. But generally, you know, we're born with certain evolutionary endowments because they helped us survive and reproduce. And without them, you know, and obviously certain evolution demands that a certain percentage of people who were born or organisms that are born are actually going to have lots of, you know, mutations and things like that, that are actually not, that means that they're not going to survive and thrive, unfortunately. But what the one of the things I want to come back on about addictions is, yes, that kind of thing in a man is very, very attractive. And I think kind of the thing that we need to be worried about, boys need to be worried about falling into maybe these kind of addictions like pornography and you know, opiates or things like that, that denotes a loss of control. That denotes that you are not in control and you are not a good partner. That a woman in a crisis cannot, a woman and your offspring cannot count on you in a crisis, because, you know, as we know, when people are addicted, it changes their whole personality, it changes their whole outlook, it changes their priorities, it changes everything, basically. And so, I mean, whether or not, you know, that is actually, again, what's meant to happen, you know, and getting young men hooked on these things younger and younger gives them a feeling, I don't know, desolation, like they're kind of never going to find a way, that there are no rites of passage anymore that men can have in order to reach manhood, in the same way that there are no, having a baby was once a rite of passage for a woman in order to reach womanhood, and that gave her status. Today it doesn't give you status. But I mean, where are the rites of passage for men? I mean, there doesn't seem to be any path, as you were saying before, any path for them, any guided path for them. At the minute, feminists are just guiding women towards, you know, annihilation, self-annihilation. And meninists, you know, that's what I call them, sorry, that people, it kind of encompasses the men's rights, red pill, I don't know, Andrew Tate, that kind of thing. It's just, you know, people who are promoting this kind of like ridiculous version of masculinity, which is basically just male competition, intersexual male competition. They're just showing off and making people feel demoralized. So yeah, they're not really models either. So I just wish people were more interested in I wish the media was more interested in actual solutions than it is in just monetizing the drama.
Well, one of the things that I would like to see, and it's very hard to get people to see or to have the maturity to come to this point, really difficult, and feminism has done a real job on this when it comes to trying to speak to women about this, which is, look, men and women are different, okay? They're different and they have different roles to play, but that does not mean that one is better than the other, okay? Mm-hmm. And this, one of the issues is, though, when you start going into what that difference is and what those different roles are, you've automatically got a narrative or a script that says the man is trying to say he's better, the man is trying to set the right. And this makes it super duper difficult to have a serious conversation about the roles of men and women, because you're just walking into this wall again and again and again of men. That if men say, look, this is what we're built for, it sounds like they're trying to say we're better than you in some way. So that this I don't know how to overcome, because I've tried in many different ways, and invariably we come up against this. You know, that to some extent motherhood's a very important thing, right, you know, to, mm-hmm. to women. To some extent, I don't know, like being a provider and all this sort of, like, it's not even being a provider. I've often thought about this in a psychological way, right? And you can tell me if you disagree or if I'm talking nonsense, but I've always thought that, like, if you're trying to get a male ego and if you're trying to get a female ego, you attack different things, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, the way to really attack a man is to attack his prowess and his abilities in various different fields, okay? This is why you might go to, well, you've got a small dick or you're crap in bed or mm-hmm. whatever, but you attack his abilities to do stuff, okay? If he's known in a certain field or area, you're claiming shit at that thing, mm-hmm. his actual ability. Whereas I'd imagine that if you attack most women on those sorts of things, they just wouldn't really give a shit. Like, they, you know, they could, no. Yeah, they may feel it, but it wouldn't, like, reduce them. Whereas if you go to a woman
and attack them, like, on their popularity.
Yeah, their popularity or even their appearance. You just say, look, mm-hmm. you're fat and ugly.
Oh, yeah.
That would reduce most women to tears in seconds. So yeah. So because that shows you at some deep-seated level, the relative weightings of these things in terms of importance are different for men and women.
Yes. Yeah.
But nobody is able to admit this. Without becoming an argument somehow.
Yeah. I mean, there are mountains of data on that, basically. Yes. What men and women find, what they prioritize, you know, in a partner, in a friend, different things, you know, and those two differences are basically what we see in the data across the world. Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, over the course of one conversation, we're not going to come up with all the solutions, but the step number one has to be that not only people in general, but the authorities and, you know, governments and so on, just have to accept the fact that you can actually have the, you know, it's like the number one thing they teach in, you know, I go to a logic course here. They talk about equivocation. Mm-hmm. Men and women are equal, okay, in terms of their rights. But that does not mean they're equal in all respects. It's two different senses of the same word.
Yeah.
And yet, the inability of people to get their head around that, it leads to the slop. It leads to the gender wars.
Yeah, and we need to work out whether, you know, that's the point, really, because that will determine how we attack it.
Mm, absolutely. Well, Paula, it's been fascinating. Where can people find you?
I'm on X at Paula Wright. Yeah, and then I've got a link tree up there that'll.
So I'll link your Twitter account in the show notes.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And people can find you there. Yeah. It's been interesting. I can't wait to see what the comments are going to be on this. It's always fun when we get into these sorts of topics, because people are very dug in on their sides. They have very, very strong views on this, depending on where they're coming from. But thanks for coming on, Paula. And see you again sometime. See you again.
Yes. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.